Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
Childhood is this wonderful protected period of immaturity where we can just imagine, we can just learn, and we can just exercise our imagination.
What is the imagination?
How does the imagination work? And what do we use it for?
Our task as adults is negotiating this fine line between if we just considered all the possibilities, we couldn't function at all. But if we didn't have any sense of possibility at all, we'd be dead. We wouldn't be able to do anything.
Our guest, Alison Gopnik from the University of California, Berkeley.
Having a reality-based view of the world and an imaginative view of the world aren't in opposition. They're exactly the same thing.
The nature of imagination.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And now you can listen to Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime, by downloading one of our podcast of the Best of Philosophy Talk.
Well, I imagine myself writing blogs all the time, and that's particularly relevant this time, Ken, because our topic is the imagination. You know, my favorite philosopher, Hume, just thought the imagination was fantastic. He thought without the imagination, we would just be tied to boring old reality. But with the imagination, we take apart the information we get in perceptions, take apart the ideas, we put them together in all sorts of new ways, and almost everything interesting and important about human life follows from that fact.
Yeah, you know, I think Hume had something right about the imagination, but I do think he probably underestimated it in a way, because he thought it was very tied to perception. And Descartes made a nice observation about kind of perceptual imagination versus what he thought of as conceiving stuff. Trying to imagine a million-sided figure, the imagination quickly runs out. You can't form a very succinct image of that. But you can conceive a million-sided figure, and you can prove all kinds of theorems about it. And so conception is different from imagination. But maybe Hume thought Descartes was too tied to perception, and Descartes didn't realize how abstract the imagination can be. I think Descartes underestimated the abstract power of the imagination.
Well, I think you're right. When I read Hume, I must say, I get the feeling that this man imagined things much more visually and imagistically than I do. I don't find my mind filling up with vision-like things when I imagine. So my imagination's kind of maybe a little more like conception or something. I don't know. Hope somebody can straighten us out about this.
Yeah, I know. Now, when you say imagination is this realm of absolute freedom, does that mean we can imagine things that are impossible and therefore can't learn anything about reality from imagination?
Well, that's a good point. Now, Hume certainly thought that the imagination was tied to the possible. And that may be connected with the fact that he thought it was very visual and you couldn't put together images, so they didn't make sense. But he'd never seen Escher drawings. So it's a big, interesting question, Ken.
Can I imagine that 2 + 2 = 5, for example? I mean, really, does just anything go in the imagination?
Well,
or are there limits to what you can imagine?
Well, you can imagine the sentence 2 + 2 = 5 being true. You can imagine yourself adding 2 + 2 and getting 5, but does either of those really amount to imagining that 2 + 2 = 5? I doubt it.
I know. Good question. You know, so look, you know, kids imagine a lot. I mean, we think of the imagination as like this realm of fiction and all that sort of stuff, and maybe not utterly serious, but kids imagine a lot. And I think their imagination is, their imagining is really important and teaches them a lot about the world. And our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and imagined with a bunch of kids. She filed this report.
When I was little, we'd make my friend's room into a spaceship and play Star Wars. I remember feeling scared, exhilarated, on a mission to save the galaxy.
I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. My father will know how to retrieve.
Experts say that playing imaginary games is a way for kids to explore all kinds of roles and emotions on their own terms.
The difference between reality and fantasy is very amorphous, but it allows kids to dip into some very significant themes in young childhood, which has to do with safety danger, independence and comfort, and life and death. And imagination allows them to experience their independence in a really vivid way.
That's Jane Perry, a research coordinator and teacher at UC Berkeley's Harold E. Jones Child Study Center.
From my own research, an example, there's these two kids and they're pretending to be hyenas. And they drop from the climbing structure, see the tire swing, run over and go, "Hey, off to New York!" And they jump on and they're immediately flying. They go back to the climbing net and they cuddle and one says, "Pretend I'm biting you, okay?"
Kids try on roles in games like adults try on outfits. They also learn to negotiate. I talked to some kids in the neighborhood.
Like at our school with Christina, we did the Incredibles also with her. We were like, "Meet me next recess at the benches or at the water fountain." Usually I really wanted to be Violet, but sometimes I didn't get to. So there'd be like two Violets at the same time and like two Jack-Jacks. It's really complicated.
If you're scared of something, maybe you can take control using imaginary play.
I play doctor. I have this little doctor set.
Children, no, they're vulnerable. They're very savvy that they live in the world of accomplished adults.
Jane Perry.
Imaginative play gives them that opportunity to feel in control, to really challenge what is, even though they're fully cognizant of the fact that they're young people in a big world.
It turns out Star Wars is still in vogue.
We do Star Wars. When I went to my friend's house, we made her room a spaceship and stuff, yeah. All my friends, they have brothers, so they would be basically the bad guys.
I asked Jane Perry what she'd tell an adult who told kids to stop pretending.
What children are doing when they're in their imaginative worlds is exactly the kind of learning experiences that they need to give them the flexibility to respond to whatever comes up in their world later in life.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
The bad guy's coming. We have to hide.
Thanks, Polly. And thanks to all your little friends for that fascinating piece. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Allison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology from the Institute of Human Development at UC Berkeley. She's author of Scientist in the Crib, and she's at work on a book about children and imagination called How Children Change the World. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, it's great to be back with you.
Hi, Allison. Great to have you here again. John Perry here. We usually think of the imagination as in the realm of the more romantic intellectuals, novelists, poets, and, of course, philosophers. But you're a psychologist and a cognitive scientist. What does a person over in the dry part of the intellect like science care about imagination? Why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about why it's interesting from a scientific perspective?
Well, of course, one of the puzzles for us as scientists is how is it that we human beings can do as much as we can? What is it that makes us different from all the other creatures around us? And what's the evolutionary function? What's the function of all of these wonderful human characteristics? And the imagination is so characteristically human, you start to wonder, what does it do? There seems to be this paradox. It seems as if it doesn't do anything. It's just there for fun. But it's rare that we have something so deep in human nature that, as it were, is just there for fun. So it starts out by thinking about what kind of function could this imagination serve? And why is it, for instance, that little children spend 24/7 in these wild, crazy, imaginative worlds?
Well, Allison, you know, Hume had a very overly broad conception of the imagination. So he would say, well, look, anytime an animal anticipates what's going to happen next, moves towards food to eat it, the imagination is involved there. So in saying it's characteristically human, you must have a little bit narrower conception of imagination. What all
right.
does it include?
Well, I think the crucial difference is that it includes the idea that you could imagine a world different from the world that you're actually in. So an animal can sort of say, here's the world I'm in, and I know that given that this world that I'm in, here's what the next thing is that will happen. What human beings can seem to be able to do is to do what you philosophers call have counterfactuals, actually think, suppose the world had been different from the way it is now, or suppose I set the premises a little bit differently. What would fall out from that? And that capacity actually means that we're not just responding to our environments, we're actually creating our environments. So one of the things I say, I'm actually talking to you from Midtown New York now. When you're in Midtown New York, you're very conscious of the fact that everything around you is imaginary from the point of view of that brain that evolved in the Pleistocene. And even in San Francisco, just about everything around you is imaginary from the perspective of our lives as gatherers.
Wait a minute. You got to explain that to me a little bit. You don't mean that the San Francisco is an unreal place, do you? Or that Midtown Manhattan is an unreal place? What do you mean when you say everything around you is imaginary from the...
Well, what I mean is our brains evolved on, a veldt somewhere where there were some rocks and trees and bushes. And everything that surrounds us now, almost everything, is a human creation. It's actually something that didn't exist in the environment in which we evolved. It's something that came about as a result of human beings imagining, this is a way my environment could be that would be better, and now let me figure out how to actually make that environment
better. So you say, like, I want to get that, I want to eat that bird up there, or I don't know, I want to eat that fish there, and my God, I can't get it with my hands. I can't get it with my bare hands. I think, how could I get that fish? And I imagine making a spear or something like that, or a fishing rod or something like that. Right. And then I set about making it. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, except that with human beings, it's even more profound, because not only can we do that sort of first-order making of tools, but then we can do something like, say, if I were in a house instead of being in this cave, it wouldn't just serve me for a single purpose. It could serve me for all sorts of purposes. And maybe the most important, crucial kind of imagination that we have as human beings is imagination about how we could actually live differently, about how we could be different and the people around us could be different, so that we can end up living in a very, very different social world than the world that we evolved in, both a different physical world and a different social world.
But can't this be kind of dangerous? I mean, imagine you're sitting in a big White House somewhere and say, gee, what would the world be like if I invaded Iraq? Well, and they said, well, it's easy to imagine that. People would come out and throw flowers in my path and everything would be fine. And then that motivates action. I mean, how do we curb the imagination so it doesn't lead us astray?
Right. Let me press this question. We can imagine all kinds of things. Some of the things we imagine are really possible, right? Mm-hmm. And we can make them possible. But some of the things we imagine are, maybe they're really distant possibilities, or maybe they're not really possible at all. And it's kind of hard to know whether you're tracking a nearby possibility or a distant possibility or even an impossibility, right? People who imagine things that are impossible, we say they're living in a fantasy world.
Right. I think one of the crucial things, and this gets back to John's point about the romantic imagination versus the scientific imagination, is we sometimes act as if imagination is just this completely freewheeling thing that in which anything can happen. But in fact, to be sort of successful, imagination actually has to be quite constrained. So it's interesting that even if you think about literary examples, like something like Harry Potter, which is a wonderful example of a really fantastic world, the reason that world works so well is that once you've set the premises, there's very strict causal inferences about what can happen next. So if this world is a world in which you can fly, then there's only certain kinds of things that you can do and not others as a result of that. And the key of imagination is to have a theory of the world, a causal representation of the world that's accurate enough so that when you imagine all the consequences, you end up with the right answers. That's the sort of key to human cognition. That's the reason why we can not only rule the world, but change the world, make the world into a new world.
That's a little tricky, though, Allison, because I can imagine faster than light travel, right? In Star Trek, you imagine warp drive, and the physics of that are really, really spooky. I mean, are really difficult. You try to give yourself what philosophers sometimes call full imaginative acquaintance with the physics of that, and it's going to run out. But still, even though you can't do that, you can still kind of build these scenarios. You build in that they can travel at warp drive, even though there's no way to imagine even how that's possible. You just kind of stipulate it.
Well, Descartes had this idea of clear and distinct ideas. You don't just say something or kind of vaguely imagine it. You try to work out in detail what would be involved in that being true, and so I suppose something like that is involved in all of science, and you can think of it as very disciplined imagining.
I think that's exactly right. What makes a science, for instance, what makes a scientific theory different from just knowing a bunch of facts, is exactly that once you have a kind of coherent map, a model of the way the world works, then you can imagine all these other possibilities, all these other places that you could be, first of all. And then, the more important thing that Ken was raising, the specific things that you'd have to do to be able to get there from here. But to imagine getting there, you have to know something about how the world works. So I think the two things are intimately connected with one another. Having an abstract picture of the world, a theory, for example, is exactly something that lets you do counterfactual thinking, lets you think about the other ways.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the nature of the imagination. Our guest is Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley.
We've been talking about the imagination and a bit about how it works. Next, we're going to ask if the imagination can teach us anything about ourselves, about others, about our world. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And even outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. So give us a call. We really want to hear from you.
What imagination teaches, plus your calls and emails, when Philosophy Talk continues.
My imagination. The Quotations. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Peria. Imagination. You're listening to a philosophy program, and you can imagine you fall into a time warp, and you're back in high school or junior high listening to the radio. The imagination's wonderful, Ken.
You're right about that. I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, the nature of the imagination. What can the imagination teach us? Have you ever learned something valuable about yourself or other people or about the world through imagining? Share your imaginings with us.
You can do that by calling 415-841-4134. I'll repeat that, 415-841-4134. And outside the Bay Area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And finally, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley. Allison, I want to go back to something that you said. You mentioned in passing counterfactuals and how we philosophers love counterfactuals. I just want to talk a little bit about what you're referring to when we talk about counterfactuals. Look, somebody tells me, you know what, if the law of gravity says if you raise something above the ground and let it go, it will fall. You know, suppose I never raise it, right? Will it fall? Well, no, because I never raised it. But the law tells you not only what will happen if, but what would happen if you were to do it. You never will do it, but if you were to do it. So the fact is you never do it. But the counterfactual has to do with what would happen if you were to do it. Now, why, John or Allison, are counterfactuals so important? Why would we care about counterfactuals?
Well, we know psychologically that, in fact, counterfactuals are incredibly important. That, in fact, people live in these worlds that they weren't quite in almost all the time. There's a great example of this from Danny Kahneman, who describes how two guys are trying to go to the airport, and they're terribly late. The taxi gets caught in traffic. Finally, they actually get to the airport, and one guy's plane was terribly, terribly delayed, and it just took off the second he arrived at the airport. He saw it leaving. The other guy's plane left on time a half an hour before, as he thought it would. Now, the question is, both of them have missed their planes, but the one who just missed the plane is going to be much more unhappy than the one who, where everything just worked out so that he missed the plane by half an hour. Now, why is that? It's as if somehow that world that was almost there is just as important as the world that is there. A poet once said the four saddest words in life are, it might have been. Well, why is it for us human beings, it might have been, are so much more important and often so much more agonizing than it is?
Well, those are fascinating results. Just to go back a minute to counterfactuals in philosophy, we can think of Allison and the psychologists as telling us about different kinds of thoughts and thinking, and counterfactual is the kind of thinking where you say, if this were to be the case, that would be the case. Philosophers have the responsibility of figuring out what makes some of those true and some of those false. Allison used this idea of the world in which you made the plane was so much closer than the world in which the guy missed it by 30 minutes made the plane. That's a metaphor that some philosophers have really cashed out, and they think when we're talking about counterfactuals, we're talking about possibilities, and those are really alternative possible worlds.
So imagination, when we imagine things that aren't, and we try and construct scenarios based on the imaginings, we're really engaging in a kind of counterfactual reasoning, right? That's your point, Allison. So that imagination is a kind of tool, a cognitive tool for kind of acquainting us with a realm of possibility, and maybe that's the only way we have of being acquainted with a realm of possibility. What do you think about that, Allison?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a metaphysical puzzles about exactly what it means to say that there really are possible worlds, but it's pretty hard, as I say, given that the world that you and I are both in was once just a possible world, the world of New York City or San Francisco. It's hard to say, well, wait a minute, there couldn't be any of those possible worlds. And I think in some sense, whether you think of it psychologically or philosophically, the fact that we can make our way through those possible worlds is such a deep fact about human nature. I mean, if you sort of think about what your world looks like, how you think you proceed through the world, it's by creating, moving your way through all this range of possibilities and trying to make a kind of journey, a quest to the world that's the world that you really want to end up living in. And so many distinctively human emotions, both hope and desire and also disappointment and guilt and regret, those really deep human emotions are all based on all the possibilities that could have happened and didn't, or all the possibilities that we hope for and don't know whether they'll happen or not.
Well, you make a really important point there, Allison, and one of the points is the connection between the possible and the future. In a way, when we look to the future, it's all possibility. And so in thinking about the future, we kind of develop the ability, it seems to me, that's involved in the imagination. And so this thinking about the future, which I suppose every animal has to do, anticipate this and anticipate that, decide which way to go, in humans becomes this full-blown ability to not only think about the future possibilities, but how things might have been in the past, to have not only hope, but deep regret. I guess that's a good thing.
Duane in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Duane.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to pick up on this conversation with some of my own experiences. I was born functionally blind. And so until I was 12 years old, when essentially one day I could see almost 20/20, long story, I was very much aware of my imagination as a child functioning to tell me about the actual and the present as opposed to the possible and the future. Because for me, objects that were, perceptually available to other people were not perceptually available to me. And so I sort of had to construct this, ongoing map of the world around me to sort of account for that. And I feel like that was kind of a.
When you regained your sight, it sounds like you did regain your sight.
Yeah.
Were your imaginings embarrassed by reality, or were they like, wow, I was a pretty good imaginer of that stuff?
In some respects, I think I did a good job. In some respects, not good at all, because it was very perceptually related. So like, with people's faces, for example, I had a very cartoonish idea of what a human face looked like. And when I finally saw what someone's face really looked like, it was kind of a shock, like, oh, God, people are kind of ugly.
I see.
But, my other experience with imagination has to do with the fact that I'm also bipolar. So I have experienced, major depression and, mania. And I've seen how, both of those can, kind of tweak with our idea of what's possible, what's not possible.
Duane, this is fascinating stuff. Allison, what do you make of Duane and his experiences?
Well, I mean, two things to say. One of them is it's a fascinating story. But one thing to say is, even typically developing children use their imagination to picture all these things that they can't actually immediately perceptually experience. So children, one of the things that we've discovered about children in the past 20 years is that they're always imagining things and knowing about things that aren't there. For example, the thoughts and ideas that are going through somebody else's minds, that's something that none of us can see. And yet all of us manage to figure out and imagine. And the second thing is, I do think it's interesting that one thing that you could think about with something like bipolar disorder is, in a way, what that's about is about possibility, that part of what happens in depression is that sense of possibility shutting off, that there isn't a future, there isn't hope. And part of what seems to happen at the other end with mania is the sense that there are just too many possibilities, too many possible things that you could do. And in a way, our task as adults is negotiating this fine line between all the incredible, if we just considered all the possibilities, we couldn't function at all. But if we didn't have any sense of possibility at all, we'd be dead. We wouldn't be able to do anything. One thing I think is interesting about children is that they seem to be, in a way, on the sort of manic end. And in fact, if you spend a lot of time with three-year-olds, they often seem a little bit like people who are in a kind of imaginative frenzy.
Yeah, you said it.
And I think that that's because their job is not the way our job is to just settle into those possibilities that are really the ones that are going to be functional. Their job is just to explore that world. And I think, Shakespeare's old thought about the madman and the lover and the poet being of imagination all compact, you could put children in there, too.
Well, we want to thank Duane for the very interesting comment with respect to children. My view is that children are wonderful till about 2 years of age. Then there's a difficult period till they're 40, and then they're wonderful again. I did have one thing about depression. Is that really the cutting off? When I'm depressed, it's not that I'm not thinking of the possibilities. It's just I'm thinking of all the different ways I can screw up what I have to do and all the different ways I can fail to do. It's not a shutting off a possibility. It's kind of a refocusing a possibility totally on the negative ones.
Yeah.
Am I atypical?
I know you're not atypical because when I'm in that mood and when I can't sleep, for example, I have many imaginings, but they're all dark. But why don't we let some more callers in here? Mark in San Bruno's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my question is, as a songwriter, regarding the Greeks' idea of the muse and inspiration and how songs and ideas just seem to come out of the blue. So I'm trying to form a question for you, but it's kind of like, where do songs come from?
Okay. We've got a psychologist as our guest. You may know that. Where do songs come from and other inspirations, Allison?
Well, I don't think we know that, but I do think, again, if we're sort of trying to think about what the function of the imagination can be, I think one way of thinking about it is that it's a way of exploring this space of possibilities that we might not be able to explore if we were just trying to think in a kind of more obvious step-by-step logical way. So I think often when we talk about things like intuition or flashes of insight or creativity, what we really mean is the operation of this unconscious logic, this logic that we don't really know about on the surface, that's saying, let me get to a different space. Let me get to a different world.
Right.
Let me get to a different possibility than the possibilities that are the ones,
Allison,
that are immediately coming to my consciousness.
Allison, I think that's a profound thought. I mean, I think the imagination is one of the things it's for is giving us walks through spaces of possibilities, right? And the richer your imagination, the more kind of acquaintance you can get with a possibility through the deployment of your imagination. I think that it's a profound capacity. And you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the imagination with Allison Gopnik. You can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134 outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Wanda in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Wanda. Are you there? Ah, we've lost Wanda.
Hello?
No, there she is. You're back, Wanda.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I grew up on a farm a good part of my childhood, and I had no companions, and I had a lot of books. I read a lot of Jules Verne, starting with Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I got hooked on science fiction. And I remember later people saying, oh, science fiction is so bad. It's such, a poor form of literature, and yet science fiction is where many bright thinkers are able to explore imaginative ideas, and the very things that are explored become reality in no time at all. And starting with Leonardo da Vinci and others, we've seen this come to pass. And I think that science, engineering, and psychology have all benefited.
So, Wanda, sounds like you're a big fan of the imagination and just the free play of the imagination. Is that right?
Well, but the free play, I mean, someone brought it up that even within an imaginary world, you make a construct. You decide that there are certain limitations, certain opportunities, and that allows the activity within that to bounce back and forth. And it can grow and it can change, but still there are constructs.
Okay.
And
okay.
I think that's very important. And I wanted to mention something that one of you speakers said that brought to mind the book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And the reason zebras don't get ulcers is because they do not waste their time imagining things that may never come. Once the lion is done chasing the zebra, the zebra calms down, his heartbeat returns to normal, all of his chemicals in his brain return to normal, and he continues eating. And he doesn't get worried about the lion until he begins to sense again that it is the proper time to begin worrying. Whereas we,
Wanda, thanks. I've got the point. It's a really nice point, Allison. I'm going to put it to you. So Wanda's making the point that the imagination is a blessing. It gives us all this science and engineering, but it's also a curse because, you know, it gives rise to ulcers. And John's
we
point
wake
about
up at 3 o'clock worrying about those damn lions.
Yeah, right. So you know, what's the kind of cost benefit analysis of the imagination?
Well, I mean, I think, again, one of the interesting thoughts is if you're thinking about children and grown-ups, I think there's some very different kind of cost-benefit trade-offs. So one way of thinking about childhood in general is childhood is this wonderful protected period of immaturity where we don't have to essentially do anything but think. We don't actually have to, you know, do any of the functional work of evolution. We don't have to mate. We don't have to fight. We don't have to worry about the lions because mom is taking care of all of that for us. And we can just... we can just imagine. We can just learn, and we can just exercise our imagination. So, Ken, when you were talking about walking through possible worlds, one way I like to think about it is children can just freely move, walk, wander through any possible worlds they want. And the trouble is we adults have to decide which one are we moving to and how are we going to drag all our furniture in there, right?
Right.
We don't have that luxury of just wandering. And I think it's interesting in terms of what Wanda was saying, that science fiction and children's literature are the two genres where we really can enjoy that sort of completely freeform, let's just wander through all those possibilities in the way that children do. And in a sense, when we're doing more adult kinds of things, we're much more thinking about, okay, what life is it that I really should live, not what are all the possible lives that I might live?
Allison, with regard to children, I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, we clearly value the development of imagination in children, and yet lately in educational theory, or at least the kind that makes the newspapers, there's been a lot of emphasis on rote learning. Children aren't learning their math tables. So the first question, I'll go ahead and ask the second one. The first question is there a real trade-off there that we need to be worried about? And the second one is, we think of literature as a good aid for children in learning how to master their imaginations and develop their imaginations. But how about video games? How about movies? How about watching TV? Is there some consensus among psychologists among when the benefits of these aids to imagination quit being benefits?
Well, in terms of the first point, I think that's a really serious point. And part of the reason that I'm writing this book is there's what I think of as there's an evil schoolmaster in Dickens called Mr. Gradgrind, who says that children just have to have facts and facts. And I think we have a lot of Mr. Gradgrinds showing up in the education establishment at the moment. And it's a disaster. I mean, part of the point is that imagination isn't just beautiful and romantic and wonderful. It's actually the most powerful form of learning that we know about. That's what the great scientists, that's what... even, you know, the greatest scientists like Einstein, it's pretty clear that what Einstein was so much better at than anybody else was not doing math. He wasn't great at doing math. He was wonderful at imagining what would happen if you just changed a few physical constants. So that's really the deepest form of learning that we have. And it would be a terrible disaster if children were sitting and just doing reading drills instead of pretending. Now, the good thing is it's pretty hard to get children to do things anyway. So they would be sitting and ignoring the teachers and just pretending secretly anyway. But as a general principle, I think that's a real issue. In terms of the second question, you know, I have the same intuition that all the other parents have of turn off the TV and get away from the computer. But I don't think we have any good evidence to believe that children can't be just as imaginative in these other media. And in a sense, part of childhood's agenda is to figure out what's going on in the adult world. It would be kind of crazy if they weren't interested in the imaginative possibilities of things like video games and computers. I think the important thing is which books are they and which video games and which computers and which television programs and which movies.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the nature and limits and power of the imagination with Allison Gopnik from the University of California at Berkeley.
We've been talking about the nature and limits of the imagination. We're gonna look at how imagination changes over the lifeline of an individual when we come back.
The things kids imagine, the things adults imagine, and the things you imagine through more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Temptations and Just My Imagination. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the nature of the imagination. Share your imaginings, at least some of them, with us. Was your imagination richer when you were a kid? Do you spend less time imagining now than you did then? Or do you simply imagine different things?
You can tell us this by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917, or email us comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Allison Gopnik of UC Berkeley. Allison, you mentioned a little bit in passing the difference between kids imagining and adult imagining. And I want to focus on that just a little bit more. I mean, suppose an adult imagines being a married man, say, imagines being married to another woman or leaving his wife, and he shares that imagining. The wife's going to say, what are you doing imagining that? I mean, there's a certain cost, at least to sharing your imaginings if you're an adult. But a kid can imagine all kinds of possible futures, and not only don't we think anything wrong with that, we think there's something right about that. Imagine for yourself all kinds of different lives, son. Right? Imagine being an artist. Imagine being an athlete. Imagine studying engineering and try to get acquainted with that. What's the difference? What explains this difference?
Well, as I say, I think in some ways the whole way that we're designed by evolution is to have this kind of division of labor between our older selves and our younger selves. Probably somewhat unfair if you're middle-aged the way that we are, because in some ways the younger selves get the better part of the deal. Our younger selves are the ones who are exploring all the different ways that human beings could be. And I think we have a lot of evidence that young people and children are really the engine that drives cultural and historical and scientific and cognitive change. And I think that's very deeply connected with the range of imaginings that they can engage in, that they can think of all of these possible ways that not only the world could be, but that they could be, that might be completely unprecedented, might be ways that no one had ever been before. And they sort of have the luxury and space early on in their lives of being able to be something that might turn out to be a terrible failure, but might turn out to be a wonderful success. I think what happens is that as adults, we're much less likely to take those risks, as in the example that you mentioned, that our imaginations become somewhat more narrowed to the things that we actually think are going to work,
but we can't take those imaginative risks anymore. But Allison, I mean, there's also, go back to one of John's examples earlier on. I mean, if you're a planner, you're planning an invasion, say. You should take on relentlessly the job of imagining all sorts of things. You know, Condi Rice said, "Oh, nobody ever imagined that guys would hijack a plane and use it as a missile." Well, yes, they did. But suppose that she was true. It was true that the policymakers didn't imagine that. We'd accuse them of a failure of imagination, right? So it's not like the imagination gets shut off and you get shut off from the responsibility to imagine just because you're an old guy, right?
Well, no. I mean, I think that's exactly the point. And I think one of the relevant facts is that the fact that children are learning so much more is connected to the fact that they're also imagining so much more. I think those two things go hand in hand. So having this enormous drive to always get more information, find out more and more about what's going on in the world, part of the reason for that is that that's a way that you can channel and check and do things with your imagination. So I think understanding, having a reality-based view of the world and an imaginative view of the world aren't in opposition. They're exactly the same thing. It's because you understand reality more deeply, because you've learned more, that then you can imagine things in a way that's going to be really productive.
We've got an email here from Sean. He says, I was wondering what the connection is between the imagination and abstract thought like math. Does developing one help develop the other? They both seem to be ways of exploring spaces of possibilities. However, there seems to be some sort of visual component to imagination that is lacking in lots of abstract thought. What do psychologists have to tell us about that, Allison?
Well, I think that's a really good point. People often think, like Hume, who you mentioned, John, think about imagination as if it was just about perception, about things like visual imagination or being able to get a perceptual picture of what the world is like. And I think one of the really important things that comes from studying children is that the kind of imagination that they do is actually already much more abstract. And I think the crucial thing is the idea of understanding causation, something Hume talked about. It's understanding the causal links between things, how one thing can make another thing happen, that really lets you have this incredibly powerful counterfactual and future reasoning to go out into the world and really change things. Just sort of being able to make a picture of something in your head isn't really as powerful as actually saying to yourself, you know, this is how something could work differently. That's the kind of imagination that engineers have. And I think one of the big discoveries in the past 20 years about children has been that even the very youngest children already have that kind of very, very abstract causal thought, and it lets them make these very, very powerful imaginative leaps.
So,
even starting to understand some of the mathematics of that, by the way.
So Descartes and Kant, who thought the imagination was not just perceptual but tied to sort of abstract possibilities, they're more right than Hume was, John. Joan in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joan.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what's your comment or question?
My comment is a couple things. One is, what about the idea that, say you become acquainted with a tree, okay, or somehow you're a child and you learn what a tree is. And so after that, since you know what a tree is, every time you are around a tree, you just apply that same experience, and you experience all trees based on that one experience of the tree, just like we do with people. We repeat the same experience that we've had over and over and over. So in a sense, we're always imagining, because we're always imagining that things are continuously repeating what we've already experienced, even though they may be different, right?
It's a good philosophical point. I mean, Hume would have given you an A+ for that, I think.
So, Allison, you want to respond to that in any way?
Yeah, I think what we've discovered is that what children are doing is, in fact, and again, this is part of the mathematics that I was just mentioning briefly, they are taking information from all the specific instances of things that they see, all the specific examples, and then they're using that information to try to generalize to new examples. The interesting thing, the really powerful thing, is that what they're doing is they're not just saying the future will be like the past. They're abstracting out an abstract causal representation of what the world is like. And that lets them not just say, okay, here's the future that will be like the past. It lets them say, here's all the possible futures that could be different from just the future that will unfold by itself. So they are learning. They are picking out structure from the world, but they're picking out much deeper, more profound structure than just saying things will be the way that they've been in the
Allison,
past.
Allison, your view makes is I like it a lot, but it seems to suggest that imagination really sort of probes a possibility space. What about impossibilities? Can we really imagine impossibilities at all, do you think?
Well, I'm imagining that that's going to be about a 30-second response.
Yeah, that's going to be a short, in brief, can we imagine impossibilities?
Well, I think insofar as we can imagine them, then they're not really impossibilities.
Right. So you think imagination really does kind of illuminate possibilities. On that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation. It's been great having you with us.
Well, I always love to come on Philosophy Talk. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Allison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology from the Institute of Human Development at UC Berkeley. She's author of The Scientist in the Crib and is working on a book about how imagination called How Children Change the World.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and the emails we didn't get a chance to read. Thank you so much. It really gives us a feeling we're doing well when we see those lights lit up, even if we can't get to all of them.
Yeah. So, John, I imagine that you're at least a little wiser today, although I know it's hard to imagine you being wiser. But
no, absolutely. I mean, Allison is such a great guest and so knowledgeable. And psychology is such a great science, I must say, giving us all this interesting stuff to think about. But the thing that comes through to me is increased appreciation of this really important difference between kind of disciplined imagining and romantic imagining. Both of them can be fun. They can be make your life worthwhile, but they are quite different. And when we say big mistakes come from lack of imagination, we're thinking about the kind of rigorous disciplined imagining that we really need to learn to do.
That's right, that our leaders need to know to do when they're going to plan invasions and stuff like that. You know, I want to say, philosophy, I really do think of philosophy as an exercise in deep imagining. You know, a lot of philosophical questions are how possibly questions. And how do you answer a how possibly question? You imagine a possibility, a possible world, and you try and describe it richly, and you say, see, it's plausible, anyway, that our world is actually like that. And now you know this is how the mind could be just part of the body. This is how free will could subsist with determinism, because I've helped you to imagine it.
Of course, some people that are awfully good at that kind of imagining can't imagine exactly how many books should be in a course plan, or how a student's going to react to what they say, or how their colleagues are going to react when they say something stupid in a department meeting. So there's all kinds of talented imaginings, I guess.
Well, that's true. And I hope we've convinced our listeners that the imagination, if they need it convincing, that the imagination is a deep, important, rich capacity, helps to distinguish man from other animals, apparently. You know, I mean, apparently no other creature imagines in quite the way that we do.
As far as we know, but not as far as we can imagine.
Yeah, and you know what? This conversation continues. I've already started it on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. Also, I imagine, therefore I blog.
You know, you can go to our website now and follow the links, and you can download podcasts of our program, and we imagine that you'll like that very much. Now, let's take Philosophy Talk to the movies. We're talking about Woody Allen's Match Point, a movie I liked a lot, and so did Ken. Match Point picks up the same plot, basically, as Theodore Dreiser's classic An American Tragedy, and the earlier movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, A Place in the Sun.
But it's not just a ripoff. It's a brilliant movie. I mean, the plot structure may be similar, but I think it's an original, creative, deep movie.
The basic plot of all of these is that the social climbing poor kid, Chris, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, can't give up the life he's got with the woman he doesn't quite love, but is very comfortable with, and the jobs and the security that offers. But he can't resist the charms of another woman, Nola, played by Scarlett Johansson. And that woman becomes pregnant and he kills her. Now, they don't all agree on what happens after that, but I'll tell you, it has a lot to do with luck.
Yes, luck. Because this movie, the philosophical point of this movie, is all about how much luck governs our lives, something that philosophers call moral luck.
Right.
So the main character in Match Point, he's a poor boy. He was born to a poor family. That's a matter of luck, right? He worked his way up. He trained hard to be a very good tennis player. He played all the top guys. But he could not stand the circuit because it so much depended on luck, on the bounce of the ball.
I think the fact that he kills his lover isn't luck. That's bad character. But it may be moral luck in the sense that a lot of us might go through life with no better character than Chris's, but never be put in quite that tempting high-pressure situation.
Exactly. And so he was morally unlucky in his character. But there's one central metaphor in this movie, one beautiful image. It's the early scene when you hear Chris's voice narrating the scene, saying people aren't willing to admit how much their lives depend on luck, right? And there's a tennis ball. It hits the net, and it bounces up, and you don't know whether it's going to fall to the left or to the right. If it falls to the left, you win the match. If it falls to the right, you lose the match. And it just bounces there and could go either way. And which way it falls is pure luck. And that's kind of the metaphor for the whole movie.
So, Ken, it seems to me that what's philosophical about this movie kind of comes in three waves. First, there's just the issue of luck, that some of us are better off, some of us are worse off, and it doesn't just depend on our character or even on our fortune. It depends a lot on luck, which way the ball bounces. Then there's the issue of moral luck. And then there's the whole issue of justice in the universe or the lack thereof.
See, here's a deeper thing. I remember my father's reaction to this movie. He was really upset because he felt sure that Chris was going to get caught. And not only that, he deserved the punishment. But the movie says there is no moral order. There is nothing in the universe that guarantees that the good will triumph and the evil will be cut out. There is nothing in the universe. And who wins and who loses, who gets punished and who gets the reward, that's all a matter of luck. It's deep down. The universe is governed by nothing but fortune. And I think Woody Allen has complete control of all these elements in this movie. So it's a brilliant movie.
I think he would have gotten an Oscar, except they didn't want him to get up there and thank his wife and daughter.
Yeah, that's another bit of moral luck.
Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in their own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, You can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.